and with special reference to the ideas of the Renaissance as expressed in the works of Jacob Böhme, the 17th century German mystic and metaphysician, whose books have so profoundly influenced European thought. Whenever one contemplates a festival of significance, such as Easter, one should first examine its recognized symbols, because a symbol is the concrete representation of a universal idea. It's a means of remembering an idea by wrapping it up in a readily available shape or form. Easter has two such symbols. The Christian cross, although of course the cross predates Christianity by thousands of years, and the Easter egg. The Persians, Jews, and Christians have always associated the giving of eggs at the spring festival with the potentialities of creation. Easter is the festival which celebrates the manifestation of life in the earth again, and all things obey a universal command to create their own kind. The egg is the symbol of potentialities, and it derives from the idea of the whole universe, the big egg-o, as a cosmic egg which contains within it the potentiality of all things. All the possibilities of expression, the non-manifested forms of things, lie within this cosmic egg. But the egg itself is passive. Of itself it cannot move. It must be fertilized, and only after fertilization are the forms within it precipitated into action. In the female of the species, the egg, or ovum, and in the plant, the seed, is first fertilized and then thrown down, or precipitated, into the material world. So with the cosmic egg. There are statements about this precipitation of the cosmic egg, this expression into action of the potentialities, in every major school of thought. Christ says that unless the seed is precipitated to the ground and corrupts, it cannot bring forth the tree. Omar Khayyam mentions the same concept in the Rubaiyat. Awake, for morning in the bowl of night has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. The stone is the precipitated cosmic egg, the fall into manifestation. For those of you who have read The Defense of the Devil, it's the self-crucified one. The whole process of the eternal potentiality precipitating into the time process and becoming manifest, identifying with the manifestation, losing awareness of its eternal source, and recognizing it again, all this is symbolically expressed in the Easter story of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. At this point, let's bring in Jacob Böhme. In his great work called Signatura Rerum, or The Signature of All Things, Böhme describes the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ in terms of its fundamental metaphysics and as a type of the whole creation. And such is the power of his interpretation that there is almost no important European theologian or philosopher who hasn't been affected by it, notwithstanding Böhme's humble origins and cobbler's trade. Blake, Law, Tillich, Berdyaev all acknowledge their debt to this gentle German. And there's evidence in his notes that Isaac Newton derived his basic theories on gravity and so on from Jacob Böhme's works. Böhme wrote a number of books, or rather, he said, the Spirit wrote them through him. He saw the whole universe, its creation, meaning, and function, in one vast vision, which was immediate and presented to him simultaneously, just as Mozart heard his symphonies in one simultaneous chord of harmonic sound. And Böhme had the tedious task of translating the simultaneity of his vision into the serial words of the time process, just as Mozart had to unravel his simultaneous block of sound into separate notes written one after the other on the paper. Each saw the whole conception in eternity and had to serialize it in order for it to be understood and manifested in time. The Signatura Rerum, or The Signature of All Things, is one of the best single books ever written, and Böhme continually warns his reader not to try and understand it in a serial sense, that is, one idea after the other. He stresses that every concept he talks about has to be seen as simultaneously coexistent with all the others, and that all the qualities and functions of creation are eternal and cannot be abstracted one from another without causing misunderstanding. The opening statement in the Signatura is that anything taught or written of without knowledge of signature is meaningless. And by this he means that all created things exist from and in one supreme and absolute sentient power, and the spirit of that power is within each created thing. This is the basis of understanding and of any sort of relationship between beings. Without the reality of that prime unity or source, there's no ground of common understanding or relationship. Burma then goes on to say that the prime creative spirit has within it many aspects or functions which reveal themselves in the world according to their own special form or signature. Thus, different shapes, sounds, and colors are the perceived signature of the particular quality or spirit working in that place, in that form. The spirit which is dominant in a man will show itself in his shape, his name, and in his color, and will sound also in his voice. To test it, hit a piece of lead, and then hit a piece of iron. Each rings or reacts in a different way, because a different quality or spirit is dominant in each. We see the same thing in color. Red is a volatile, stimulating color. Blue is a cool, calm color, and so on. The name is the description in sound patterns of a form which is a motion pattern in the field of power. Only by recognizing the signature of a particular quality can one understand the spirit which is at work in that thing. And it's only a more fundamental statement of the difference we easily observe, for instance, between the shapes or signatures of an ascetic and a glutton. We recognize a different quality in each. But this dominant spirit is not fixed forever, because we live in a dynamic universe, and because each one being contains within it all the qualities or spirits or functions of the Supreme Spirit. But they're placed in a hierarchy in any given individual which is unique to himself. So, if a man of powerful and persuasive logic talks to a man who is dominated by appetite, then the logically dominated one may overthrow the dominant appetite in the other by calling forth his logic. Burma says of this, "Who has the hammer that can strike my bell?" Let us look more closely at these qualities or spirits, as Burma variously calls them. Before creation, Burma describes as a nothing, a no thing, because a thing is a finite or created form, and as yet no form has been expressed. This no thing is a state of non-manifestation, where all the potentialities of being lie unstressed in a kind of sleep. In Hindu philosophy, it's called pralaya, the balanced, even state prior to creation, when all the powers are equilibrated, a state of maximum entropy in scientific terms. Burma describes it as a sea of light in which there are no differentiated parts, but all is one light. He then says that in this no-thing, there arose a will to something. In other words, in the wholly free non-being arose a will to manifestation or objectification. Burma puts it that the will desired to know itself and see itself for what it is. And this is the first movement of the eternal towards differentiation of value by objectification, the first tension or gathering together of energy into a motive force is the first movement towards self-knowledge. If you lie down and relax your body completely, you'll very quickly begin to lose awareness of your shape, of the edges of your integument. And it's only by contracting or gathering yourself together again that you regain awareness of your fingers and toes. This is something like the first gathering together of the eternal in a will to objectify itself. And it is the first differentiation, because it causes change in the place of gathering together, a dynamic imbalance in the field, a stress. We might illustrate it by holding out the open hand, palm upwards. This is a passive gesture and simulates the pre-creation passivity. Then, if you gather the hand into a fist, you have the first contraction into objectification. Fist and first are closely related, by the way. Put into diagrammatic form, we might draw a line spiraling into a center, indicating that a contraction or compression is taking place. This first movement of the eternal sentient power, Burma calls Saturn. Now let's pause for a moment and examine Burma's use of terms. In Burma's day, philosophy and physical science were not separate as they are today. They were regarded as aspects of the total truth and considered by the best thinkers of the day as a linked study. Thus, the best alchemists of the 17th century were not deluded quacks who used astrological terms in the loose, uninformed manner of modern newspaper predictionists. To the alchemists, the seven planets, the transmutation of metals, the philosopher's stone, were precise functions and processes of a universal system. The seven planets were the symbols of the seven primary functions, or spirits as they were called in the terminology of the day, which lie at the root of all creative processes. They were technical terms in the highest sense, used as carefully defined tools of thought, which revealed the fundamental laws of the universe. We've seen that the first, or fist, the contraction onto a center, is Saturn. As such, it's the beginning of definition, and therefore the beginning of value. Because if there is no defined limit, there is no value. But value might also be said to veil you, and that is exactly what Saturn's compaction does. For when compaction or compression occurs, it brings with it the fact of density or resistance. And this density or resistance impairs light and understanding, because it's a block, a bar, a limiting factor. If we go back to the open hand into fist illustration, we're aware that as the fingers close up, the air is expressed between them. The air is the symbol of the free spirit, and the fleshly density which supersedes it is the result of the saturnine compression. It's the same concept as the curse or the coursing out of God's spirit, which is mentioned in Genesis. The compaction of Saturn makes darkness or lack of understanding. As well as making darkness and density, the compression upon a center causes pain to arise in that compressive zone. Psychologically, you know that enclosure and pressure give rise to a panic desire to escape the pressure because it's unpleasant. In the power sense, as understood by Burma, the reaction to this painful compression of Saturn causes an opposite will to arise. A will to return to the free, non-constrained no-thing, the free field. So, we have Saturn pressing in, causing a reaction or an opposite will to arise, and a polarization of those two opposing wills. The opposing will to expansion is called by Burma Jupiter. It is that spirit which prefers the free, untrammeled immediacy of the uncompressed field. It is a will to escape the bondage which Saturn imposes. This is the first opposition and the necessary prerequisite of creation. When we talked earlier about gaining awareness by tension, that tension is a product of the opposition between Jupiter and Saturn. You cannot make a meaningful gesture, you cannot create a gesture, or indeed anything else, without this opposition. If you stretch out your arm, and at the same time try to pull it back, you'll get the feeling of Saturn-Jupiter in action. So now, we have the first opposition between compression and expansion. And the opposition of two forces causes a rotation at the point of their intersection. This is a law of motion. And a spin, a rotation, is set up. And so, we have a diagram of a cross inside a circle. And the cross symbolizes the opposition of the two forces, and the circle is the closed sphere which is set up by their rotation. So we can now see in Burma's system both the cross and the Easter egg, and also, incidentally, the hot cross bun. And we'll see where the hot comes from in a moment. The rotation, which is set up by the opposition of Saturn and Jupiter, is called Mercury, which means both rotation and also breaking up. Burma indeed calls it the breaking wheel. And Mercury is the symbol of articulation and analysis and formal differentiation, because the contrary wills to contraction and expansion within a closed system must necessarily break up the original unity of that sphere. The cosmic egg of potentiality is made up of these prime universal functions, and all is contained within this egg of birth and death. Birth, because it's a beginning of the life of nature, as we know it in time, and death, because it's now cut off from the infinite by the boundary, or, as the Bible calls it, the firmament, which is set up by the rotation. This fixing, or limiting within a closed sphere, is called the cosmic crucifixion. You may remember that in the soliloquy from the cross, Christ talks about God the Father having pinned himself on his cosmic cross from the beginning. This is that cross of existence upon which the infinite sentient power crucifies or pins itself. It is a committal to finity. It's impossible to consider compression, expansion, and the consequent rotation without including the concept of heat, which is set up by the friction of the opposition. Heat, and its psychological attribute of anger, is the function of Mars. His is the heated, warring, worrying anger set up in the bondage of the created sphere. And heat is a vital component of the motion in Mercury. And of course both heat and motion are the essentials of life. So now we have Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, and Mars. Now Jupiter really belongs to the free, unbounded infinity outside the closed system. And so we're left with three: Saturn, Mercury, and Mars. These belong to the bounded sphere of created nature. They're the beginning of finity and the committal to objective form. Therefore, Burma calls them the three nails of the cross. Let's recapitulate what they signify. The first will to being is Saturn, which is the first closure or compressive spirit. The pain of the compression sets up the opposite will back to the free, unbound field, and that is Jupiter. The limiting factor, or the bondage, prevents the Jupiterian will from escaping, and the two opposing forces, Jupiter-Saturn, set up a spin. And this is Mercury, the wheel of creation, whose unity is broken up into discrete particles by the opposing motions within it. Mars is the principle of heat set up within the closed sphere by the friction of opposition. We see that the will experiences pain as it moves into the compression. It tries to escape, but it can't get beyond the limit. It becomes very heated as it rushes around trying to get away. And the nearer it gets to the compression center, the harder the squeeze and the greater the pain. So it rushes outwards again to the perimeter, and so on. And the sphere grows darker and darker as the action zone is ingrained deeper and deeper with experience. This corresponds with the material world of action experience, the veil of darkness and death the Bible talks about. Christ symbolizes the opposition and darkness in the finite being in his agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. Agony means action in a closed situation. He agonizes because of the pain of the finite situation compressing his being in the Saturnine grip. And his Jupiter will prays that this cup may be taken away from him. The heat engendered by his agony makes him sweat blood, and the heat is, of course, Mars. Let us look at the geometry of Burma's system again. You'll notice that as the will spirals in to a center, it doesn't go to a point at dead center, but leaves a small, tight circle before it moves outwards again as the Jupiterian will. Inside that center limit of the zone of action, there is a circle of unmarked paper, which is in fact the same as the unmarked paper outside the sphere of action. That untouched still center is what enables movement to go on in the closed sphere. If the Saturnine will spiraled into dead center, that's exactly what it would become, dead. Movement would be impossible if it went to a point. So the empty center is like the action hole which allows the wheel to turn. It is a catalyst at the center of the being, which by doing nothing allows everything else to happen around it. It is the infinite inside the finite, and it's the resurrection point, the only point from which the being is able to regain its identity with the infinite unbound power. The being cannot escape the pain of identification by going outwards, because the saturnine compression won't let it. So it can only escape by pressing in, through the pain, through the darkness, and so gain access to that door to eternity which is within its own self. That still center is the Spirit of God in all men. Consider that in order to be free, the will has to press in to the compression, the heat, and the disintegration of Saturn, Mars, and Mercury. It must disregard the will to escape from the pain outwards, towards the perimeter. That perimeter, incidentally, signifies superficiality. The choice has to be made either to stay on the perimeter and be superficial, to be on the outer rim, or to be free by pressing through the hellish zone, the zone of action, to the center of free, unconstrained will, like that which was lost in the first compression to manifestation. In the crucifixion story, Christ shows man that there is only one choice that will set man free again, and he shows it by willing to be crucified, that is, committed to be nailed on the opposition zone of this world. He accepts and wills the necessary crucifixion and the going down into the darkness of death in the words, "Except the seed falls to the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit." Unless your potentiality is precipitated into the darkness and the heat and the corruptibility of the time process, you cannot gain the fruit of experience. The action zone in the closed sphere is what has been called the dark night of the soul, the darkness of ignorance, or hell. The point where the experiential groove is higher than the head. But at the moment when the decision is made, when the will is reconceived to go inwards through the compression and the pain of the darkness to that center where the light is, a change occurs. There's a rule that any motion carried to its term inverts and becomes its opposite. Thus, when the will to self-crucifixion or committal to acceptance of the fact of darkness is carried to its term, the dark, compressed sphere incandesces and expands. Let's look at it like this. If the will spirals into a center, the compression grows stronger and more unbearable. But if it's persisted in, the density of the compression creates so much heat that the whole sphere incandesces and gives off light. In Burma's terms, when the will presses into the center, there is a flash as of lightning, and the substance of the sphere is illuminated. And this illumination is the same as that experienced by all the mystics of all the religions. One moment they are in the extreme of darkness and despair, and suddenly the term of the process is reached, and they receive a blinding flash of understanding of the whole process. The light is a recognition or a seeing again of what the being knew in eternity, and the being is thus reunited in the eternal sentient power, what Burma calls the liberty. In the flash of light, the will sees the whole situation, and there is a separation in the being. The light rises, and the darkness of the saturnine process is dismayed, says Burma, and falls back from the light. Then, says Burma, a terrification occurs, and by this he means literally that tear, the material earth, is made. There is a crystallization of the Saturn, Mars, Mercury will into materiality. It is a condensation of their function. This is now the dead body of flesh which Christ rises from in the resurrection. He is now identified with the light and severs his connection with the dark materiality, the partial, bound sphere. There's a reference to this in the statement, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not." Because the comprehension is in Jupiter, and the saturnine darkness therefore cannot comprehend it. Burma calls all the compressive, heat-making and breaking-up processes prior to the incandescence the wrath of God, and the light he calls the love of God. And he points out that they're rooted one in another. The will to objectification, or thingness, has its root in the love of God. God so loved the world, etc. And the reconceived will to the light has its roots in the darkness of objectification. Both coexist, and it's abstract thinking to consider one without the other. The understanding and the comprehension in the light, or the illuminated, is rightly called love. Because love means to develop the potential of a being. So now we have our Easter egg again. Christ's love, or his will to develop the potential in a man, sent him willingly to crucifixion, death, and resurrection, in order to show to man the way to saving and developing himself to the full actualization of his potential power. That is the meaning of Easter, and it's the meaning of salvation. If one injures oneself, one eases the pain and the heat of the wound by applying a salve, some soothing oil. And Burma says that the love is an oil, a kind of compassion born of comprehension. And he calls this oil of love Venus. Venus, he says, is the dear, lovely child. And there is direct reference here to Christ saying that unless you become as little children, ye cannot enter the kingdom of light, or eternal self-awareness. The child, like love, is innocent, and innocence does not divide or judge, but links and relates. Venus acts as a lubrication or a soothing or mollifying agent upon the fierceness of Saturn, Mercury, and Mars, much as one puts oil on a grindstone to ease its cutting effect on the blade. Venus eases the friction and gentles their condition by giving them toleration. Thus, Saturn's grip becomes no more than a firm tension or a self-awareness. Mars gives a gentle warmth instead of a fierce heat, and Mercury becomes a mirror of the infinite forms of the eternal potentiality. Now, the given light, the understanding, the comprehension, the authority, and the balance which the reconceived will has gained by its experience in time, is now called Sol, or the Sun. And it's the symbol of sovereignty and is an expression of the will's reflexive self-consciousness. The being is now Solus, or Solus, because it is alone, or all one, with itself. And it stands, like the Son of God, between the world and eternity. Burma calls Sol the heart of God and the heart of his powers. Sol is the great orderer, the central authority, which by its powers draws life again out of the dead earth. In the Shakespeare lecture, we heard Shakespeare talking about the sun in these same terms. So now, from the first enclosure of Saturn, we've come round to the reconceived will, sitting on the right hand of power after its long journey in search of itself. There remains one more primary spirit to identify. And this final, this seventh spirit, is called by Burma Luna, the moon. And she's set opposite to the sun, the active initiating power, and she is thus a passive spirit. She's the receptacle, the cabinet, to use Burma's word, of the whole process. In her passive sphere, the other spirits work and move. And as substantial, she has a lot to do with procreation and also with woman. She is, in one sense, the womb in which the creation is brought to fulfillment. Thus, she has a lot to do with phasic desire, cyclic movements in the closed sphere. And as she is the substance on which experience is engrammed, she's concerned with memory, the mind in its passive aspect. She remembers the work, the movements, the forms of the other six spirits. Identification with the moon process is identification with the substantiality, the material creation. Christ, who points the way to self-realization and reflexive self-consciousness, says he's come to destroy the works of woman, meaning this identification with materiality and phasic behavior characteristic of Luna, the mother, the passive receptacle of the universe. Of course, we've only had time in this talk to touch lightly on the signature of all things of Jacob Burma. but I hope you will have been stimulated to want to know more of this 17th century German cobbler who was illuminated by the flash in Mercury. You won't find his books easy to come by, nor indeed easy to read, but then the best things never are. But they repay the search. This talk is a continuation of the subject which was started in tape number one, namely the work of Jacob Boehmer. On this occasion, we're going to look at another aspect of Boehmer's teaching. I say another aspect because it's only another face of the same eternal power working in its own substance. So that tonight we're not talking about a subject different from the seven spirits we discussed in tape number one, but another facet of that same system of thought, another way of looking at it. Boehmer posits that there is a threefold principle of being, and that the originating power, although one and undivided, is a triune spirit, in that it has three functions, and they correspond with the Trinity which is found in all major religions. In Christianity it's called Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And this idea of the three principles is not separate from the idea of the seven spirits, but integral with them and in the continuum of power. The symbol of this continuum of power is the seamless garment of Christ, the mesh woven by the absolute sentient power in its movements. It's without joins or seams, and within its weaving is the totality of all forms whatsoever. We shall see this weaving image again in a moment. This continuum, the one, as Boehmer calls it, is not a passive quietness but a dynamic potentiality of power. We might indicate it on paper as a line representing the power moving continuously and creating, by its intersections, all the possibilities of form. They are possibilities because although they are eternal realities, they are not as yet stressed, and therefore not manifest in a concreted or precipitated action zone. That mesh of power is a very important symbol. One sometimes sees it as a grid, which is the rationalized form of the power mesh. You see it on the heraldic arms of canny gentlemen who've learned the rules of the game, and can therefore rule. The game of chess, with the moves of the pieces over a checkered board, is also derived from the original game of power, this eternal mesh of the absolute sentient power. Now that drawing of the mesh, made by the pencil of power weaving about freely on the paper, contains within itself Boehmer's three principles. And they are sulfur, mercury, and sal. These are the three worlds, the threefold life, the triune spirit. Let's see how they arise. The motion of pure power has no inertia. It's entirely without limitation. It is pure, free. Therefore, it's the motion of light, the swiftest, because it is the highest frequency. So we may say that the motion of the power flux in our drawing on the paper is like light translating. That light is one of the three principles. Now we come to a curious dialectic opposition. When this translating power of light weaves about, it crosses over itself, it intersects with itself. At the point of intersection, there is therefore, as the word crossing implies, an interference. Interference because it's a hindering, an obstruction, or obscuring, which implies a relative darkness. And this is why a special branch of physics was made to study interferometry, or the behavior of light waves when they intersect. So we have another of the three principles here, eternal dark. Dark means hidden, secret, and it is the opposite of light or the shown. It's hidden in eternity within the infinity of light. Boehmer says of it that it is like a room with a light on. The darkness is there, but it is hidden and isn't manifested until the light is turned out. In the talk on the seven spirits, we mentioned the law of motion, which says that where forces intersect or cross, the opposition creates a rotation around the point of intersection. Therefore, when the motion of light crosses itself, it creates not only a relative darkness, but a rotation in conjunction with it. And we may abstract a particular example from our mesh drawing and look at it separately. And if we do this, we shall see that it's our old friend, the cross in the circle. The cross in the circle is an absolutely basic symbol. The three principles are implicit within it, and therefore the whole meaning of life and existence is contained within that symbol. But on this occasion, we must make the lines of force, the vertical arm of the cross, and the horizontal arm, transcend the limits of the circle to show that we are at the moment referring to the eternal, where there is no separation but a continual motion. It's only in time that the circle becomes the limitation. We have to remember, too, that it's only when we abstract this symbol from the whole mesh of power that we see two opposing forces, because in the eternal it is the one power which creates the opposition within itself. It crosses itself. There is not two, there is the one power. It's only when we abstract or stress a particular that we lose sight of the larger wholeness, which of course is the cause of all our troubles. In this eternal field of power, there is no encapsulating, no fixing, no committing to external manifestation. There is no expression yet, because expression and encapsulation within a limited sphere is a result of stressing a particular, an identification, a definition. We might take as an analogy of this power flux the field of the room or the locale we are in, with the air full of radio waves of varying frequencies all intersecting and crossing around us and through us. These are the potentialities, the motions of energy. They're potentialities which only become actual if I or you decide to stress one frequency rather than another. I tune into one station and thereby make it actual. I manifest it. But in doing so, I cut myself off from all the other possible programs that I could be tuning into. By including one, I exclude all the others from my consciousness. By saying yes to one, I necessarily say no to all the others. But the eternal flux is unstressed. It is pure motion whose power patterns give rise and fall to fantastical world systems in a never-ceasing flow. The Bible refers to these non-fixed, non-established worlds that come and go as the Edomite kingdoms. The Edomites were desert nomads who wandered about from place to place without establishing themselves in a given place and building a boundary wall round themselves and saying, "This is mine," and thus starting the concept of property. Now let's translate these principles of the dark, light, and rotating functions in terms of Burma's three principles. He calls his first principle Sulfa, and we should write it as S-U-L hyphen P-H-U-R, Sul and Fur, because it has two forms. The light motion we saw in the mesh, the movement of eternal power, unconstrained, is the Sul. It is free, the eternal liberty, Burma calls it, and it corresponds with the person of the Son in the Trinity, the love of God. This is the will which conceives within itself a desire to objectify itself, to see and to know itself, and to manifest its hidden forms, its potentialities in sound and colour. But in itself, it is absolutely free, and therefore it is called Sul. We can't call it Sol yet, because there is no encircling, no O, no serpent with tail in mouth, indicating finity. It's Sul. The second part of the word, Fur, arises from the will to manifest, which is conceived in Sul. Fur is called the desire of Sul, in that it is the beginning of nature. Sul initiates the movement, but the moment the movement starts, we call it Fur, desire, or the aftermotion of will. These two are not separated. The reason they have two names, cell and fur, is because when a movement or a function changes, you have to change the name that goes with it, because the two are closely related. Now, Verma doesn't call fur nature in the sense of the time world, but in an eternal sense of the movement of the absolute to objectify itself. Fur is the desire of soul for manifestation, and it is equated with God the Father because it's the original of life and the maker of essence. And essence is the issuance or driving forth of soul's desire to objectify. And as desire, it's called fur. Because soul, in order to objectify and to see itself, has to oppose itself or cross itself, because creation is impossible without opposition, the fur is called the darkness. And because you can't have opposition without heat, the fur or the father is called the dark fire, the wrath of God. And the soul is called the light, the love of God. But Burma says that they mustn't be understood in the eternal sense to be divided. They each give rise to the other, just as in a flame there is light and also a dark heat. One is soul and the other is fur. And yet they can't be abstracted from each other, and each reciprocally feeds the other. The dark heat gives rise to the light, and the light is the cause of the dark heat. Now, the desire in fur for objective form is a cause of anxiety arising. Anxiety is the motion of the fur, the desire, to oppose itself in order to manifest its forms in nature, to commit itself, to crucify itself. And Burma calls it angst in the German, and it's a hunger, a desire to be filled, because it's still a no thing. It's a hunger to actualize its potential. Now, as soon as fur, the desire to formulate, begins to cross or oppose within itself, it creates the mercurial spin. And within that spinning zone, there's a continuation of the process, a multiplication of spins within the great spin, which is the manifestation of the different forms within the eternal. And this is why Burma calls Mercury the word, the articulation, the speaking out of the will of the absolute. And that speaking is the formulation aspect. To speak in this sense is to create a rationale or a Torah in the terming. Torah is the Hebrew word for law, and law is a cyclic function, an ordering system of rotations, and it makes an ordered system by its limiting action. It's a law, and if we look at law in Hebraica, back to front, it becomes wall. And a wall, again, is an idea of limitation, of definition. Now, Mercury is non-comprehensible, according to Burma. That is to say, it's the motion which causes the geometry of the sphere. It's not tangible, just as one cannot, for instance, touch thoughts. They are non-comprehensible. But just as thoughts have a comprehensible house which they make for themselves, a substance in which they have their being, so also Mercury makes for itself a substance, a house or body. And this is the third principle, and it's called Sal, S-A-L. We can sum it all up in terms of the behavior of power in a field. When fur arises, it's a compressive force, a desire to condense itself and become manifest. The compression in the field causes a locality or zone of relative intensity, which is thereby denser than the surrounding field. The compression is also a cause of movement intensification, rather like the same sort of thing that happens in a Venturi effect. If you restrict a column of air by squeezing it in a smaller and smaller tube, the column of air will speed up. are just as people, if you funnel them through a narrow tube, will speed up as they go through the restriction and then slow down again as they open out, for instance, onto the platform of a station. Now, because there is an increase of compression, an opposition is set up, namely a desire or a movement to even out the differences between the compressive zone and the field without by expanding. If you compress a gross material substance, its molecules will increase their motion in an attempt to escape the compression. So there is an opposition within the compressive zone, a reaction to the compression. The uncompressed field is SELV, the light path, and considered as the first movement to compression, and therefore as the father of the whole process, FER is the desire of SELV. SELV initiates, but from that point on, as we've said before, we have to change the term as the function changes. Now the heat and the darkness engendered by the FER, by the desired manifestation, makes it the wrathful aspect of God. The Lord thy God is a jealous God, because the compression is the beginning of the idea of property, of grab, of ownership, or limitation. These two, SUL, the light power, or the absolutely free will, and FER, the desire of that SUL to nature and to manifestation, and therefore called the dark fire, both are in one. They interact with each other, they give rise to each other. Now considered as the motion, that is the wheeling and the causing of multiplicity of rotation within this compressive zone, Mercury is the moving judgment, the formulator, the divider. And it's in the wheeling motion of Mercury that the separation of light and dark occurs in a great explosion, as we shall see later. And Mercury is in this sense the mirror of the absolute will. Considered as the substantiality or the density of this compressive zone caused by the squeeze, SAL is the house of the process, a kind of crystallization of the whole process in tangible form. If we draw two concentric circles, in the inner one we would put SAL as the heart of the whole process. SAL is the free, the light, the love of God, the unconstrained. This is the originator of FER, which is its desire to formulate the wonders which are hidden within it. That desire, which is like a terrible hunger, will put in the next circle. The cell drives outward from itself and becomes FER. And the state of FER is a state of angst. The angst is rather like the state of Brutus in Julius Caesar, when he knows that he has to kill Caesar. That is the equivalent of our will to formulation. And at the same time, the actual carrying out of the murder of Caesar, the concrete actuality, is an unknown quality. Just as in the will to formulation, the actuality of form is an unknown quality. And there is the angst, the ambivalence of the will, looking back and forward. Back to its non-committed free state, forward to its formulation and bondage. The one will to go again into the free, the other will bound to go into the formulation. Now the Saturnine will goes on compressing, but the Jupiterian will wants to expand again back into the soul. It's the reconceived will back to freedom. And this is the opposition, the ground of Mercury, or the whirling about in the battle between the will to escape and the will to bind. And in Mercury is the separation point. Burma says it's rather like what happens when water is poured on fire. If we take the water as the symbol of the meekness and the gentleness of the free, unbound soul, and the fire as the heat and the anguished motion in FER, then the action of the two on each other is catastrophic. There is an explosion, and in the explosion, one part of the fire goes dead and black, and the other part leaps up in a great burst of light. In other words, one will remains and is confirmed in the impression, the compression. That's the Saturnine will to objectification. And the other will, that Jupiterian will, the affirmer of the whole comprehension in the field, returns to the free, unconstrained field. The will that remains bound in the compression is now in Mercury, which is that moving, unquiet, stinging, disintegrating sphere. Mercury contains all the opposition and the multiplicity of motions within itself, and it's therefore the formulation of all the colours, the sounds and shapes of all things. But as we've said, it's not a tangible thing, it's not a body, it's rather the motion of that body. And it's the real beginning of mobility. In the dark sense, that is, in the wrathful sense, the drive to formulation, it is like a venom, a poisonous sharpness which disintegrates everything into a terrible bitterness. And in the light sense, or in the love sense, it's the highest formulation of the wonders of the eternal mind. In the dark, it's the function of the devil, the divider. And in the light, it is the function of the Son of God, the Logos, the articulator, or mirror of the divine wisdom. In the light, it's the sharpness of consciousness. And in the dark, it is the beginning of enmity. And Sal is the substantial aspect of this Mercury. It's the body of Mercury, if you like. According to the light will, it's a body of light. According to the dark will, to formulation, it's the coagulation, the condensation into materia. And the outward limit of Sal, the point at the perimeter where contingent contact with another such body is possible, that is the beginning of materiality and the time world, the term of the whole process. We could say that this is the final statement in Sal, a T at the end, which makes it salt. Let us examine this outward going will, this will to formulation, separately. If we identify with the compression into form, we're then cut off from the light of the free will in Sal. So we move in darkness, which is ignorance. And because of the opposition which is implied in darkness, we become a mercurial wheel, the particularizing process in Mercury. We're disintegrated into a multiplicity of tiny separate wills, all dominated by different purposes, being the expressions of all the possibilities in the divine power. Between the different wills of these separated functions of our disintegrating being, heat is generated, which makes the whole process more and more painful. Meantime, the compression in Saturn is making the whole thing more material, more harsh, more unyielding. And the process is a vicious circle, from anxiety in the fur, caused by the ambivalent will, through the consequent disintegration of the unity in Mercury, and into the material world of ignorance, friction, and pain, which is Sal. This painful actuality makes the angst, the anxiety, even stronger, and so on. We have said that the process begins in the fur. Fur is thus the father, and his will to continue outwards in the dark compression is the devil, the opposite of life. But the will to reconceive itself back into the cell is called the recall to life, which is the Son of Light, or the cosmic Jesus Christ, as against the Son of Darkness, or the cosmic devil. And this is all the Bible is talking about in the story of Genesis. The same story is told in the creation of man and his subsequent history. In paradise, which means before judgment, before separation and disintegration, Adam belongs to the eternal sulfur, mercury, and Sal. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is the choice presented in fur, which is the beginning of anxiety. Adam is tempted to go along the separative path of formal differentiation, and is thus precipitated into the fall, the pall or the darkness, which is created by the compression, friction, and disintegration. In other words, Adam falls into partiality. And as we have seen, he is now under the domination of the dark world, the world of the devil, which only means the divider. Because that separation in fur is a separation to birth and to death. The birth is the birth of life, that is, the reconception of the will to soul, and the death is the falling back into the formulative process, which again means the division and the subsequent ignorance. And in identifying with that formulative process, the division, the Adamic man is now cut off from the life. He cannot get out of the dark ignorance again until the light shines again in his darkness and regenerates the fallen man. This light, which shines back into the darkness and kindles its life, the life of cell again in the dead substance, is Christ, who shows in his life, his death and resurrection, the entire process. And this process of sulfur, mercury and cell is contained in every man, every woman, indeed everything. We see it again, for instance, in the next generation from Adam. The separate wills here are expressed as Cain and Abel. Abel is the will which looks back towards its source in Sal, and Cain is the one who is determined on the long course, the formulative course, the vicious circle that we've been discussing, which precipitates him into Mercury and Sal. We see the same process again in the creation in Genesis. The earth, without form and void, is the result of the separative will. The darkness and the deadness is the death which occurs after the flagrat, the great division in Mercury. And it's the result of the confirmation of the will to compression. And God, if you remember, regenerates this deadness by saying, "Let there be light." He creates Sol, the sun. And Sol is the given light, because it's a material likeness of the Sol, the liberty, the eternal power. It's called Sol. And the O now puts it into material being, and therefore it is a given symbol of the eternal soul. In every case, there is a principle of darkness or separativity, and a principle of light or wholeness. And the third principle, the soul, is the mixture of these two in the outward world. Thus every man has in him the light of the spirit or free will, and its desire to objectify or bind itself. That is sulfur. The result of the interaction of sul and fur creates mind, Mercury, and the precipitation of the forms in Mercury into a material body is sul. And man stands in the mixed world of good and evil, and he always has to choose or evaluate between them. So, sul is the originating power of the eternal light. Fur is the natural life, the desire to objectify, which causes heat and darkness. Mercury is the formulating motion of nature and life, the articulation process. And sul contains the whole process and is the house or body of it. And to sum up then, the first principle is the father, or fire, the dark world. The second principle is the sun, or light, the heart. And the third principle we might call, as in the Christian doctrine, the Holy Ghost, the source of man's world, of the elements and the stars, and etc., the mixture, which is a result of the interaction of the first principle of fire and darkness, and the second principle of light and love. Having listened to this talk, you will naturally want to gain the maximum benefit from the ideas contained within it. To do this, it's most helpful to use the remainder of this tape for your own observations, first to remember, and then in subsequent replayings to add to your observation until you've built up a synopsis of the talk in your own words, in your own personal vocabulary. Only thus can you be sure of substantializing these concepts.